Gammy. But why would you have to choose? Daddy wasn't making any sense. Oh, said Daddy casually, flipping the current batch of three pancakes just in time. If I weren't smart enough not to have to choose. Maybe we could save the plaque, Laura said quickly. We could bring it home and keep it here. Daddy agreed. We could save the plaque. But what about Ms. Ritchick? Laura asked. Where would she go?
Oh, we'd save her, too.
Maybe, Daddy added. We'd take her home, too. She could share your room. Daddy. No, I'd find her another job. Ms. Ritchick is so good at her job that that would be easy. At another bank, you mean? Laura distinctly did not like the idea of Ms. Ritchick working at someone else's bank. If she wanted to. Father and daughter waited for the bubbles to appear in the two cooking circles of batter. It was as if they were both thinking the same thing, for Laura didn't feel self-conscious when she protested suddenly. But Mummy likes the bank.
Yes.
She has nothing against it. It's just I think life would be simpler at the farm. At 7, she already knew it was her job to keep a conversation with a man going, to suss out the right, the cordial response. She could feel Daddy glancing at her, but she stayed focused on the pancakes, embarrassed because she wasn't totally sure what she'd just said. She was only quoting, after all. Ruth had woken up. She appeared in the kitchen in her nightgown with her blankie as Daddy and Laura were sitting down at the table to eat. Laura didn't feel like sharing Daddy, but maybe Ruth would cheer him up. "It's almost my birthday," her little sister said. Daddy and Laura laughed. And Laura said, "It's not your birthday for 2 months, Ruthie." She immediately thought of the secret, of the puppies who had been born up at the farm and were now being hidden away at Billy Flood's house so Ruthie wouldn't know. She thought of the puppies, and she didn't say a word, though she glanced at Daddy and had to press her lips together, and her face twitched when he raised his eyebrows at her. "I'm inviting my whole class." "Are you sure?" Laura asked skeptically, and with a pang, wondering if Mummy had allowed this. "Did you ask Mummy?" "She said I could." Ruth climbed onto a chair. "Did Mummy say Ruth could have the whole class?" Daddy nodded, passing Ruth the plate of pancakes. "Oh, yes, the whole class and all the neighbors and all the kids from jumping gymnastics and..."
"Junior's gym!" Ruth squealed. "It's Junior's gym!"
"Everyone's invited to the plaza for a seated dinner for 200. We'll have caviar and lobster bisque and champagne flowing out of ice sculptures."
"Daddy!"
"That's what Mummy said." Ruth, knowing she was being teased, pursed her lips tolerantly. She poured far too much syrup on her pancakes, in Laura's opinion, and murmured, "I'm inviting the whole class plus Arabella."
"Who's Arabella?"
Laura asked, suspicious again, for Mummy wasn't always so hot on the details. She might have said Ruth could invite some totally inappropriate person, like an older child whose mother would make her come and who would ridicule the younger kids and the younger kid activities and be a liability.
"Arabella's my friend," Ruth said,
frowning as she worked at using her knife and fork to cut her pancakes.
"My new friend, who I made, Arabella Curtis."
Then the weight pressed on Laura again, for Daddy spoke in the fake, fishing way that other inferior parents spoke, but never him or Mummy. He said, paying too much attention, "Is Arabella Curtis your friend, Ruthie?" Repeating, for no reason at all, what Ruth had just said. "Your new friend, who you made." Chapter 13. A charity function, the caption said. The New York Landmarks Protection Society. The Times photo showed Jed Skinker and his wife in evening dress, arriving at the winter ball 2 years ago, their coats open, her dress long and glittering. Not only was Mrs. Skinker tall, she had that slouchless assurance in her height, as if, in Dan's opinion, she were exercising a right, her genetic privilege to be taller than you. Dan had been looking at the picture for weeks now. He couldn't shake the unpleasant feeling that he was squinting through a peephole, ogling a world he could never enter. That wasn't saying much, but the fact was he wasn't talking about a socioeconomic barrier so much as a genre divide. He felt as if he dwelled in some hackneyed network sitcom,
whereas the Skinkers inhabited a public television drama, a featured television event. He pictured the parties in their world as more lavish, the marital fights uglier, every constituent a knight or a joker. It was neurotic nowadays when the meritocracy had never been more ascendant to dwell on the accident of birth. But the Skinkers brought you up short, reminded you that the fancy restaurants and four-star hotels, the idea of which you preoccupied yourself with, were middle-class treats, candies on sticks to keep you quiet in the bleacher seat. Better, maybe, to be like Gwen and eschew all that. One of those people who like to eat at fancy restaurants, she would say of some acquaintance she had consigned to terminal mediocrity. A Thursday toward the end of March, the workday coming to a close, 4 weeks into the Lenten regime. No sweets, no bread, no booze. And to run across the Brooklyn Bridge every day after work. Why? Because it was there. He was out of excuses, and any jerk could get through 2 miles, even a sad, out-of-shape desk jockey like himself. Already dressed for the run, Dan put a foot up on the edge of his desk and tightened the laces of his worn-out running shoes. He had never been able to bring himself to join a gym. He would start his cross-examination of the poor benighted health club employee during the tour of the machine room. Maybe not even let him or her make it to the membership pitch, when his rejecting, obstructionist mindset proclaimed it all bullshit. If you really want to get in shape, all you need is a pair of sneakers. What would it be like, he wondered, to go through life saying, yes, please, and sure, why not, and okay, I'll give it a try, rather than no, 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 as if his mission here was to let nothing get past him. He noticed a growing hole on the little toe side of the sneaker. Don't whine, you'll get new ones when you get through this. This. He zipped up his windbreaker and glanced at his watch, though there was nowhere he had to be. Gwen had taken Mary up to her parents in Massachusetts for the 2 weeks of spring break. Next year we'll go away, Dan promised, feeling panicked as he embraced her outside of Penn Station. Okay, sure. Gwen didn't seem to hang on the idea. And it was only when he had left them and was heading down to the office to put in a few weekend hours that Dan realized he'd pulled a Perry Hogan. He'd made a promise about a future trip that might never happen. Not because, like his father, he couldn't afford it. He could, just. But because he simply wasn't all that interested in vacationing and assumed she wasn't either. He missed them now. The apartment felt deserted. Getting takeout every night and running the dishwasher with 3 plates in it. He didn't feel quite as rebellious as he used to, or sick of himself for not living up to her standards. It was very important that he focus on the small ways in which he wasn't living up to her standards. He still caved and bought the occasional 6-pack of paper towels, a luxury that Gwen hadn't grown up with and had deemed unnecessary. Dan eyed the photograph. There were several in the file by this point. Clips from Skinker's wife's modeling days. Her look then more mainstream pretty, less edgy than you'd expect. Sober corporate board profiles of CEO Jedediah Hussey Skinker. But the Times photo was the one he kept coming back to, seemingly unable to move on from the glam shot. Though the case itself had moved on. Had moved right along. The pieces falling into place. One sickening click after another. All the reasoning he had done. The painstaking reasoning of convincing himself that Skinker was in the clear. Had to be in the clear. Had been for naught. He almost still couldn't believe it, pathetic as that was. In the photo you could see that something had disturbed her, though not the flash of the camera. She wasn't looking at it. Nor was she looking at Dan himself, he had noted. Though he'd positioned the clipping this way and that to see if he could catch her eye. But just past it. Eyes open wide. With alarm, he'd thought initially. But he had studied the picture for so long that he could now detect nuances in the Skinker's facial expressions he hadn't caught before. He suspected that hers wasn't a startled reaction to something specific, so much as an everyday kind of thing, the unfocused intensity in which she habitually dwelled. He guessed that she was always being gripped by something, alarmed by something. They said that about alcoholics, about addicts of all kinds, that they could think only one step ahead. Sometimes when he looked at it long enough, the photo would start to irritate Dan. He'd have an impulse to shake her, to shake the short-sightedness off her face, make her notice her husband or him, maybe, something. But that was his thing. Jed Skinker himself didn't seem concerned. The man radiated largesse. He reminded Dan of a benevolent dictator, the tolerant till crossed demeanor. Or was Dan back in Bidville High SAT prep, confusing largesse with actual largeness? Skinker's bulk harkened back to a time when rich people ate the most. Handsome couple, even DiNapoli agreed. Good-looking people, Danny, he'd said when Dan showed him the photograph. Very attractive people. Dan deliberated a second, then snatched the picture off his desk and folded it into the inner pocket of his windbreaker with his apartment keys and metro card. He gave the desk an exasperated, perfunctory tidy and turned out the light. His plan was to run over the bridge and back, then hop the train home. He had to get out, get some air. This thing was starting to suffocate him. It was one of those days not long after the time change. The early evening light when he came out onto St. Andrew's Plaza startled him. Dan glanced almost shyly at the sky. This time of year always made him feel as if he'd been given a personal reprieve, blessed in some way that didn't apply to everyone else. He darted across the traffic on Park Row and set off at a quick pace for the bridge. He hated the start of every run, hated every step of it, thinking, Jesus, motherfucker, fuck running. But knowing it was only a matter of keeping going. Run it off. Run it off. He's too caught up in the case, that's all. He needs to get his head straight, get some perspective. Dan's hope that Jed Skinker had nothing whatever to do with John D. Curtis vanished for good a week after his lunch with Brenda Przinski. The bank's phone records came in, incriminating as hell. He appealed nakedly to her sense of logic. I'm telling you, though, Bren, it makes no sense. If you knew the guy. Sorry, Danny. Where had he read that mourning had five phases, and the first was denial? Dan feels a cramp in his side and accelerates onto the bridge, trying to contain his irritation at the slow-moving tourists who clog the first 50 yards even this late in the day. For now, there is no longer any question who Curtis's connection at Skinker Far is, whom he had spoken to, patched through each time by one Carol Ann Richick, Jed Skinker's personal assistant. Curtis not even bothering to call Skinker's cell phone. That same theme of flagrancy Dan recognized from the Tamco case. The secretary herself is coming in tomorrow morning at 7. Dan understands he will have to have the box of Kleenex ready. DiNapoli, doing his kinder, gentler approach, nevertheless reported that after he showed up at her apartment up in Yonkers the other night, modest, meticulously kept, plastic covers over the living room furniture, she had gone into the bathroom, closed herself in while DiNapoli waited, and broken down. Wept most pathetically, Danny. Before she emerged, having redone her makeup, and agreed to come into the office and talk to them. Though you'll find I have almost nothing to say. Dan alternately breathes into his side and tries to ignore the cramp. He'll never let himself get this out of shape again. Swear to God. He barks the words aloud over the noise of the traffic below in an effort to contain the pain. Focuses on the American flag that flies from the top of the first tower, as if it could speed him along. Despite the damning evidence of the phone records, Dan felt he had done an admirable job of keeping denial going at first. He had turned back twice to Carlos Flores, the drug offender in the print shop. He'd already told DiNapoli to consider him as a potential suspect. Now he ordered the full workup, the man's name plugged into a dozen federal databases. He'd spent 90 minutes explaining to Matt Nast why a tipper-tippee relationship between Jed Skinker and John Curtis, in which the former was beholden to the latter, would never exist. 'Cause it's all backward. It bothered him. Then it angered him. All at once, denial was over, and now, apparently, he had moved on to anger. Skinker had played him. Somehow he'd missed the hint when he'd met the guy at school that all was not as it seemed. Some nefarious angle in the farm drainage conversation. He'd been duped. He'd been taken in by the Skinker mystique, and he'd been duped. His lungs are burning. For God's sake, he can barely move. He's so pathetically out of shape. Can barely put one foot in front of the other, but somehow he does. He keeps going, slogging around the straggling packs of late afternoon tourists. The well-adjusted souls who walk home to Brooklyn to enjoy some fresh air to stay active. He'll never be like that, taking a pleasant walk for exercise. As long as he can remember himself as a cognizant being,
It's been all or nothing. Drink all night and run it off in the morning. Somehow he keeps going. Just keeps going. And like the glimpse of some tourist's fluorescent jacket he keeps seeing in front of him, the truth flashes before him as well. Hadn't he, in fact, always known? Hadn't his mind flitted to the truth the very moment Brenda pronounced the words skinker far that lunchtime a month ago on the plaza? Her. The man's wife. His beautiful wife. His beautiful wife who drank. Dan glances to the right, south, to take in the harbor, the shipping containers, and the cranes in Red Hook, as if his pointed observation of such things, Dan Hogan's bearing witness, can beef up the connection the city maintains, more tenuous every year, to an industrial past, to the ports and the trade and the working classes. The surface of the walkway beneath his feet has changed from metal to wooden slats. And surprise, surprise, he's suddenly in a rhythm. Not exactly enjoying the run, that'll come later, but at least he knows he won't quit. In the end, he got lucky. Unbelievably feel bad about it lucky, given his reluctance to focus on Skinker. He doesn't like to dwell on that either, as if the luck might diminish his competence, but he's standing there at the Steins party 2 weeks ago, sober as an AA sponsor, giving Gwen the let's-go signal, when he gets handed it. Handed the connection, like one of those flaky pastry canapés Lally Stein had served, that seemed to make Dan hungrier and hungrier the more of them he ate. She knew Curtis. Skinker's wife had recognized Curtis. Was seemingly shocked senseless by the unexpected presence of John Curtis at a St. Timothy's parents' event. Whoa, was the brilliant thought he remembers having. Wait just a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. But he couldn't catch up. Couldn't think that fast. That reaction. All out of proportion for a parent night. Maybe the reason it took him a while to process it was that terror. At an Upper East Side school gathering isn't one's go-to emotional read. What the hell was that? Was Dan's opener when they had left the Steins and were across park. Gwen at her usual race walk to get home and relieve the babysitter. Dan striding alongside. I saw Curtis come in. Didn't really relish the idea of a chat, so I jumped behind the coat rack. I thought Miss Blonde Cruise Director was going to have me arrested for disorderly conduct. He'd glanced at Gwen. He could usually get her with even a suggestion of the humor that had been so lacking in her childhood. He liked to make her laugh. Please, sir, allow me to get your coat for you. Please, sir, unhand the plastic hanger. I will take down the garment. Gwen, however, had gone white with affront. Surprised and not quite sure what to make of it, Dan was silent for a block or two, keeping pace with her, stealing looks at her profile, waiting for an opening. But she was practically twitching with disgust. I see Curtis go in. He tried again, affecting a puzzled tone. I look up the stairs, see you trying to introduce them. The next thing you know, I see her come tearing down like she's being chased. He paused. They're not heading up the PTA together, I take it. The early March night had been raw and damp. Dan had been glad to be walking at a pace that would warm him up, glad to be out of that mausoleum of a house, most particularly glad that his kid was going to public school next year. And yes, in the back of his mind, he knew that what was spurring all this gladness was the fact that he had it. Whether Gwen or anyone liked it, whether it was unfair or cheating somehow, he had the connection between Skinker and Curtis. He had been handed it. Live. And even if he had known intuitively where the one liability in the man's life of circumspection and duty lay, it wasn't the same as seeing that reaction of hers. Fleeing the man, she'd practically run Dan over. He'd cleared his throat tentatively. Was that about Curtis, do you think? Was that why she took off like that? Or was she just plastered? I did see her hitting the bar. Do they know each other? How would they know each other? Bizarre. Gwen had stopped on the street and looked at him with the closest thing to dislike he'd ever seen on her face. He must have raped her, Dan. What? Whoa. He put up his palms as if dropping something. Okay, maybe he was playing dumb a little. What did you say? Truth was, the idea had crossed his mind as well. Tightly, with a threatening note now. You heard me, Dan. Was that hysteria lurking in Gwen Babineau's voice? Right, okay. Dan conceded quickly. He gave a solemn nod to show he was being serious, no more joking, and hurried after her as she started ferociously down the block again. And now he knew he'd really better not open his mouth, because his main reaction to the word rape had always been reflexive denial. "It wasn't me," he always wanted to say when women mentioned it in that pissy tone they used. As if, as an irritating piece of college graffiti had claimed, all heterosexual sex was rape. "Right, right," he repeated. Fuck it. He would drop it. Drop the topic for the night. Gwen rarely got angry. Her rational weighing of the pros and cons. Her calm willingness to see the other guy's side. Maybe he just didn't realize. Were the 5-bar pens that corral Dan's free-floating rage. Somehow he felt that if he pushed her on it, and she didn't want to be pushed, the whole thing would explode in his face. As they waited to cross York, he considered telling her about it all. Why not come clean? Make Gwen his ally. Lord knows he needed one. She must realize he was investigating Curtis. Must have guessed the moment he told her not to start hanging around Minnie Curtis and her kid. He could come right out now and tell her Jed Skinker was on the other side. The husband of her childhood acquaintance. That he wasn't just gossiping tonight. He had to know the history between Curtis and Skinker's wife. Did she know anything? Could she help him out? But the light changed, and Dan balked at the idea. His wife was already uncomfortably close to the investigation. The only thing saving it from being an utter clusterfuck was her ignorance as to the latest developments. If Dan were to inform her that he was investigating the Skinkers as well? Side by side, the two of them neared their building. Gwen was the stablest person he'd ever known. That was why her unpredictability on the subject of the Skinkers unnerved him. In the muted light of the elevator, he wished he could get a better look at her face. What was she thinking behind that forbidding, but also oddly forgiving, mien? She had taken a stand tonight. She cared. For some reason relating to her childhood, maybe, she cared about Skinker's wife. He gave her a lame smile as the elevator stopped on 5. No way was he going to tell her. The quick pace as he gains the first tower is starting to feel unsustainable, but Dan pushes on, annoyed now rather than agonizing that it's still so hard. To be clear, as far as the Stein's party, Gwen's assumption was also his assumption, the only plausible explanation for her reaction. The guy is a known rapist, after all.
Weird how the jury is not still out on that. How you could be a rapist.
Not some guy who'd had a few and had an aggressive streak, but a guy who, given the opportunity, raped women. Or maybe looked for the opportunity. Found the opportunity and fucked them against their will. Overpowered them and fucked them. Fucking disgusting. He wondered when it had happened. In her 20s, maybe? Her modeling days? A lot of guys had a thing about models. Or, more recently, a one-night stand after she was married. That would help explain the terror. If Mrs. Skinker had cheated on her husband, she had picked the worst possible guy in the tri-state area to do it with. It creeped Dan out thinking about the twistedness of the Curtis psyche. You get a man's wife into bed, an alcoholic, easy target. You rape her, 'cause that's your thing. And then, as a bonus, you force the husband to tip you off on material non-public information. The truth was, it didn't make perfect sense to him. It didn't totally gel. But Dan could guess at the range of leverage that might be available to Curtis after only one night with that unhinged woman. Skinker's beautiful wife. Who drank. Who'd apparently signed up for one night of indiscretion with a 100-year-old bank as collateral. Played roulette with a livelihood of 200 people, if this brought Skinker far down. 20 minutes after the last call, we get the trade, he hears Brenda saying. Dan feels sick. Fuck. As the cramp returns with a piercing jab. One night of indiscretion. One night. Frequently, what hits Dan the most about his own transgression is the unfairness of his not being able to make it go away. One night. One stupid night. How could it be the case that he couldn't go back in time and erase it? Make it so that it never happened. From time to time, he's thought of pulling Diane aside and asking her directly for her eternal silence. Can we agree that this never happened? He grimaces as he makes it to the second tower. He raises his eyes to the plaque to the Roeblings. At some point, he memorized the wording, just because he thought he should. that it might be a clever thing to trot out. John Roebling, who gave his life to the bridge. Emily Roebling, back of every great work we can find the self-sacrificing devotion of a woman. Then he's past the tower and running downhill toward Brooklyn. He's gotten through the worst. The red capitals of the watchtower sign weirdly majestic to his right. The crazy shit people get into during their time on Earth. Skinker's wife. That was the little game Dan was playing with himself, pretending he didn't know her name, not wanting to expose himself in that way. Admit that he knew her name. Mrs. Skinker. The wife of Jedediah Skinker. Before that, she'd had a couple mick jobs. Her only real job was as a legal assistant at the Midtown firm Fordyce Crandall. Before that, modeling, Japan, and that funny fact that she came from Massachusetts, one town over from Gwen. The nice town with a boarding school, the colonial houses, and when we were little, a hunt club still. Dunning, the town where Gwen's brother, Bobby, was now a sergeant in the six-man police force, catching teenagers partying by the Natauqua River after graduation, driving the veterans in an open car for the Memorial Day parade. Gwen had shyly let it slip, half embarrassed, in Mary's first days of preschool that she couldn't believe it, but there was a mother at the school whom she knew, or sort of knew. Well, didn't exactly know, but had known. "Did you say hi?" he'd asked impatiently, already annoyed by this woman who had some hold over his wife. "I did. I said hi to her, even though I really only knew her sister. Gosh." She became atypically self-absorbed for a moment, smiled to herself, said softly, "She was a model. Can you believe it? Someone from Dunning. She went all the way. Not just magazines, but magazine covers." Dan had promptly changed the subject. He didn't like to see his wife beholden. He didn't like to see her in awe of someone, not Gwen. Shortly thereafter, of course, he met the woman himself, at the parents' night when he had spoken to Skinker. "Why, she's just a drunk," he remembers thinking. The great Mrs. Skinker, his wife's hallowed childhood pal. No more than a public drunk. He'd said as much to Gwen, but it didn't seem to register. "She's so incredibly poised," she'd said another day. "She'll stand there at school not talking to anyone, with no self-consciousness at all about it. I could never do that. I always have to pretend to be doing something." Dan had coughed and excused himself. Was it up to him to tell her that Skinker's wife was simply practicing the extreme conservation of movement of the wildly hungover? He feels almost cheerful as he presses along now. The scope of it all. The boat traffic on the expansive river. The cool evening air and light. Perfect night for a run. Why, he wonders, do people have so little self-control? He doesn't get it. Why does she let herself go? Why not have just a shred of self-discipline? He could put her on a program, tell her what to do. 6 out of 7, his draconian rule. When he isn't on the wagon, as he is now, Dan gets through the weeks ticking off the nights when he doesn't drink at all. Friday nights, sure, all bets are off. If he and Gwen stay in, he sometimes drinks 9 beers. Or if they go out to dinner, which they don't do that often, because he sees through the allure of it. Prefers Gwen's cooking and toggling between ESPN and the late-night talk shows. He'll have 3 or 4 vodka tonics and a bottle of wine. Don't kid yourself that you're sharing it. But he contains it. Jesus, can't she at least contain it? Gwen never judges Dan overtly. Gwen isn't judgmental. Her message seems to be that she has better things to do than look down on people and criticize choices that have no earthly effect on her. His wife simply never acknowledges that weakness is a possibility. Many times in the past, Dan wished she would criticize him, wished she would at least say something. On their wedding night, just to choose a random example, when he got blind drunk at the bar of the Dunning Inn, for some reason he'd counted on a little wifely nagging out of the gate, a little preemptive guilt-tripping. Maybe just a, "Really, Dan? Tonight?" when she overheard him asking Bobby to bring him another, this time a double. None came. That was 14 years ago. None has ever come. A few weeks ago, in anticipation of the Ash Wednesday cutoff looming, he insisted on opening a fresh bottle of white over dessert. She wouldn't even say, "Well, I'm done. I don't want any more." Put the onus on him for whatever happened next. She just watched him out of those pale blue eyes. okay. Yearly, he performed this ritual of giving it up altogether, and though he dangled that fact repeatedly, feeling more well-rested these days, she wouldn't comment on that either. She, whom he married because he felt alive under her disapproval, now voices no disapproval. Long before the Steins' party, Gwen, he realizes now, with a sort of insight only cardiovascular exercise seems to afford him, went silent. The darkness in his soul makes him afraid that her disgust with him is so total that light-hearted chastisement was off the table forever. But in the moments when he lies beside her before sleep cancels his thoughts, he feels that that is himself talking, saint and sinner, and that she is more simply waiting. He curses himself, and sometimes he speaks to her sleeping body. I promise. Or, I'm really going to. And he places a hand as lightly as he can on her ribcage, shuts his eyes, and prays. Take me in. Take me in. Take me in. Dan forces himself to sprint the last 50 yards. He tags what he considers the Brooklyn end of the bridge, a lamppost where the walkway flutters out before its long stretch into the borough. Instead of turning around, he snatches the Times photo out of the pocket of his windbreaker and looks at it, obsessed bastard that he is. It fucking irks him that the woman's weakness is public knowledge, often public display. Skinker ought to say something, do something, get after her for God's sake, or for the sake of his children. What sort of mother doesn't keep herself in hand? Is she habitually drunk in front of her kids? Jesus. Dan scrutinizes the photo for another minute, the wind off the bridge rifling it so he has to hold it open with his two hands. He's furious at himself for not getting the second half of the run over with, but he stands there, getting chilly in the breeze as the sweat dries on him. He glances at Skinker's profile. Christ, why doesn't he say anything? In a different way altogether from Gwen, the man looks as if he would consider it beneath himself to comment on his wife's drinking. Or not that, Dan thinks. It was not some prurience that holds him back. The man looks as if he came, long ago, to some constancy and vision of which his reserve on the topic of his wife's drinking is the merest footnote. People like that, though? Dan shook his head. He crushes the clipping in his hand and starts back up the bridge. People like her. He won't say it aloud, but it's almost as if she needs a smart slap just to get her out of her own head for 5 minutes. He runs along, lighter now, faster. The buildings on the other side rising up before him. Brutalist 70s eyesore. The courthouse and municipal building. And he pictures her in her haughty vacancy, ignoring a slap. Ignoring an actual slap in the face. Impervious, like one of those inflatable dolls. Slap, slap, slap. No reaction. She seems like the kind of person one can't get through to. The kind of person experience will never change. Maybe the initial attraction to Curtis was some type of masochistic urge. Maybe she picked up on his nihilism and knew he'd be the right choice for a night away. Bizarrely, the thought starts to turn him on. It's twisted, but it turns him on. The idea of just fucking her and getting no reaction at all. Hell, he'll take anything that'll get him through this run. He runs faster and faster along the bridge till he's flying. He's the fittest man in this whole goddamn town. He races toward Manhattan, imagining himself giving it to Skinker's wife as she ignored the fuck out of him. When he was done, he felt for his keys and his Metro card in the pocket of his windbreaker, ran his fingers through his hair, but hesitated at the entrance to the subway, looking down the stairs to the train. He glanced back toward St. Andrew's Plaza, the building. The office would be mostly deserted by now, but Diane was working late on Madoff. When he remembered that moment when, at the bottom of the subway stairs, he had pushed his face against hers, and they had kissed, and he had realized, oh my God, what was going to happen. The thrill of realization, the anticipation so acute, he stood motionless, reliving it. It had been ecstasy, that moment. He knew that now. Metro card in hand, he limped a little going down the stairs to the train. Had to grab the handrail like an old man. His muscles were starting to tighten on him. And the whole ride home, he had that look on his face that old people sometimes get when they're alone and trying to remember something. Half concentration, half confusion. As if someone was keeping them in the dark. Chapter 14. This guy I know from the training program tells me we're going to go out to meet some girls at 5757. You know, that's where all the high-end prostitutes hang out, I tell him. Don't laugh, he says. I give him a, you crazy, look. He just waits. Rob went the other night, he says. Now I'm waiting, about 50 yards out of my depth here. I got a name. Derry takes a card out of his pocket with a big shit-eating grin. Katya. I told him, no, there's no way. Had the Series 7 exam in the morning, and I had to spend the night cramming. Right. Derry and I get there. We're hanging out with these Russian chicks, two of them. Katya wasn't there, though. She never showed up. Or maybe that was just a name, you know, like asbestos poisoning. Call 1-800-MARGARITA. These two were with, they both had American names, but they were stage names. You think we're so dumb we can't pronounce Lyubov? Chris says. One of the girls takes him up on it. She's like, okay, starts going to town on what fucking idiots Americans are. It's Ukraine, not the Ukraine. Why you say the Ukraine? You know Soviet Union? SSR? What do you think it means? What do you think R means? It means republic. Ukraine was Republic of Soviet Union. This is when he's asking her where she's from. When she's done, my man Chris lets out a torrent of Russian, picked up from Sasha, a Muscovite on the desk. Probably said, I want to have hot sex with your mother's dog. She's laughing, rolling her eyes. Only Russian? You don't speak Ukrainian? Well, after that, whenever we wanted to refer to the night, we'd say, only Russian? You don't speak Ukrainian? Although let's say I wasn't all that hot on referring to the night. The other one's softer, more subservient. Chris is digging the bossy one, but then this deeply, deeply unappetizing guy shows up. Swarthy dude, gold bracelets, pinky ring. And Lisa gets all excited and leaves us to go sit at his table, or rather perch at his table. So now we're down to one Russian. Just like that, somebody else comes over to us. Only she's American. I start talking to her because the other one is freaking me out. Too Slavish, you know? She was all, and how about you, guy? Do you support any football team in particular? I just can't do it. Too weird. I close my eyes and imagine getting it on with this girl, and I got nothing. No can do, even with my eyes closed. It's looking like it's going to be a long night. Chris would never drop a thing once he got going. But this American girl, she's pretty cool. A little freaky. Laughing a lot in odd moments. Really loudly. Really crazy laugh. Tall, like a model. Dyed blonde hair. Dyed blonde as hell. Platinum hell. Keeps looking over her shoulder like some kind of druggie. But turns out to be kind of fun. Ironic, like. She gets jokes. I buy her a drink and I'm like, what about you? You from Ukraine too?
No, she says, doing the other girl's accent. I from Massachusetts. Republic. New England.
Oh, the Bay State, I say. Didn't know they had hookers there. I get really embarrassed, really red in the face. Oh, my God, I wanted to die. Obviously, you don't say it, right? You don't refer to the fact. That must be like hiring a high-end hooker 101, solicitation for dummies. I am so over my head here. It made dating look good. But she gives me this deadpan look, and finally, she laughs. Finds it funny. That freaky laugh. So I buy her another drink, a Cosmo. Cosmos were in then. Had just gotten in. She could put it away. Drain the second one before I finish paying. I get her another, tell her to slow down. I can't afford drinks at these prices. Again, what a thing to say. How was I going to afford her, right? We went back to Chris and his chick, but it wasn't that fun. Chris has to, like, be the star of it all, you know? And he starts eyeing my girl, and I'm like, fuck this. And I think she was, too. Yes, like a mega dork, I thought she liked me. Liked me. We kind of go off by ourselves, and I lose track of Chris. Chris, by the way, just to let you know how that worked out, passed out on the subway, woke up at the end of the R line with no cash in his wallet. And, get this, his Blockbuster video card gone. $500 in free rentals, I guess. No idea how he got there. Sun's rising. Stamp on his hand from a Chelsea nightclub. Said the last thing he remembered was getting in a black car with Lisa, the hairy guy and the sycophantic girl. That was my buddy Chris's night. So I go off with this girl and I'm starting to relax, but that wasn't good enough for me, apparently, because this wave of determination comes on, as it sometimes does, and I'm like, fuck it.
I'm going to get seriously, seriously hammered. I was so stressed. So stressed. We're working these crazy hours, you know? We were second-year analysts, working 80 or 100-hour weeks. I had a share in a house in Hampton Bays, $7,500. I went out for one night all summer. That's how that amortized. I was supposed to be dating this Greenwich girl, Vivi, who I met through Angie Fry, who was on the desk with us. And it was just so beat. If you don't want to be in a relationship, guy, just tell me. Well, I guess I'm sort of... What? What? You think something's wrong with me? You don't know how lucky you are. Whereas this hooker's the coolest thing ever. A revelation. She didn't talk too much, but she wasn't like the silent, judgmental type either. I mean, obviously, I guess. Not much in it for her if she was judgmental. But you felt like she actually thought everyone was a fucking compromised asshole, except for me. I felt like I was really entertaining. Like she really, really liked me. We had a bunch of gin and tonics and we tried to go out dancing down in the West 20s, but we got dissed by some shithead bouncer said I was too corporate. I started screaming my head off at him. Prone to overreaction. That's what my year-end evaluation said that year. I said, fuck it, let's go back to my place. She's all, yep. I was too wasted to start stressing, but I wasn't totally sure she was a prostitute. I.e., I wasn't totally sure she was going to put out for money. It was confusing. I kind of felt like I wanted to date her. But at the same time, I was worried. I'll admit it, I was worried about the actual transaction. She smoothed that over, though. You go back to my place. Honestly, I was embarrassed to be taking her there, call girl or no. Place was such a fucking sty. I'd blown off my roommate a few months before and moved into a studio on West 87th because I patronized a bar near there. I had a cleaning service come once a week and dig me out, but I think they hadn't shown up or something because there were pizza boxes everywhere and Chinese food open. In the bed. It was seriously gross. I started cleaning up, throwing shit into the trash. I was trying to explain that while I was gross. I wasn't that gross. And she's like, don't worry about it, guy. Take it easy, guy. She's been kind of riffing on my name all night. I felt like an idiot having given her my real name. Hi, I'm Guy DeGroat, and I'll be your client for the evening. My name's pretty uncommon, and I knew she'd remember it. But for some reason, I don't know. God, I don't know what's wrong with me. Ugh. I wanted her to know my name. I wanted to make a connection with her. I wanted her to remember me. I was still thinking I'd, like, pull a Richard Gere, and save her from all that. Still thinking I'd be dating her. Except I knew somehow she wouldn't date me. I knew I wasn't good enough for her. I had a cane from when I hurt my foot playing squash at the River Club. She found it lying around somewhere. I put on a Velvet Underground CD and she was dancing around to it. She was dancing around using the cane, kind of vaudeville, modeling it. Then she turned it upside down and she sang Sweet Jane. And then she sang Oh Sweet Nothing, just totally deadpan, staring at me. It kind of freaked me out. It was turning into kind of a downer vibe, so I changed it up, put on some hit music station. And she sang that Ace of Base song that was so big. God, it takes me back, that shitty music. That radio station, when I got to the city, everybody hurts. And then we did a duet, too. We're both leaning into the cane, microphone. She was really good. Not a great singer. Her voice was kind of low and breathy, but a fucking amazing presence. Then she made me do something. Come on, guy, what are you, scared? So I did Over the Hills and Far Away. Really loud. Mega air guitar. Oh, my God. Kill me now. Look at me, I'm turning red just remembering it. We polished off the famous grouse, and then we did it on my futon. But before we did it, she's like, you're gonna have to pay me now, you know. Oh, shit. Right. She told me it was $500. Oh, shit. Well, what'd you think? No, it's cool. I had $80 in my wallet, and I had left $100 in the drawer for the cleaning people who hadn't come. I talked her into letting me give her a deposit. By then, of course, I didn't want to have sex with her, so I just sat down on the futon, turned on the TV, started flipping channels. But as I'm watching TV, she's like unbuckling my belt. She starts giving me a blowjob. Holy shit. She's an actual prostitute. She's a prostitute. And right. Then I realize she's beautiful. I'd been talking to her all night and thinking she was fun and kind of cool. And then suddenly I saw she had this perfect face, perfect features under all the makeup and just, well, to see her degrading herself. She got me turned on, though, so I hauled her up and had sex with her. Kind of glad to get it over with, to tell the truth. She was pretty quiet, didn't say much during it, looked kind of blank. She was on top. She was really quiet afterward. I mean, dead silent, staring, her arms around her knees, and I thought, oh, no. This is going to be like the other week when I cheated on Vivi. And it was fun to a point, but then after I fucked her, this girl starts crying and telling me she wants to transition laterally from the account side to creative, and she doesn't believe in Santa Claus. Those were the days, man. Then I fucking remembered I had a Series 7 exam in the morning, and I dragged out the binder to study. Big surprise, I couldn't concentrate. I got the brilliant idea to take some speed. Not real speed. I'd ended up with my roommate's bottle of ADD drugs, and I took a couple here and there so I could cope. I offered her some, and she looked kind of mad and said, I don't do drugs. I sat there trying to study with my eyes glazing over. And I did that for maybe 5 minutes while she wandered around looking through my stuff. Finally, she starts flipping channels, and there's this movie on. You know, one of those flicks chronicling someone's descent into alcoholism. Days of Wine and Roses, I think it was Jack Lemmon. I know it was. Great flick, great flick. Of course, I started watching it with her. She was way into it. She'd shush me if I tried to talk. We sit there drinking Ricard with water. That's all I had left in the cupboard. And watching this movie. God, what a crazy night. What a fucking crazy night. Sometimes I'm sitting on the couch with Anne staring at Seinfeld and my mind flicks back to some incident from my 20s. And I just can't believe that what I remembered happening happened. We actually sat there and watched this Jack Lemmon film for like 2 hours. And she found this backgammon set I had stowed away somewhere. Monogrammed leather backgammon set. Vivi had way level jumped on the relationship and given it to me for my birthday like 2 weeks into dating. You want to play? I asked her. We sat there and played backgammon until 3 in the morning. She wasn't bad, but I still crushed her. I ordered my usual hangover cure from the deli. Got one for her, too. 2 bacon, egg, and cheeses on a hard roll. We decided to eat at my kitchen table. That and my futon, first furniture I ever bought. We ate there, all civilized. She put on my Dartmouth squash t-shirt. She's like, oh, were you friends with George Voorhees? I'm like, what the hell? How the hell do you know him? Turns out, she went to Dunning. Dunning. The hooker I hired was a day student at Dunning. I don't even know what day it is anymore. How the hell did you get into this? I ask. So, she told me. When she was little, she wanted to be a model, and her mom wanted her to be a model. She didn't remember whose idea it was originally. Point was, it's not like her mom made her do it. They both thought she should do it, although she did say she was doing it before she could remember. Her dad was an older guy, really old, and he died, and the mom, who sounds like a real piece of work, raised her and her sister. Before long, she's getting into all this weird shit with me. Guy de growth. I must have had some nice guy aura. Like, it wasn't her real father. Her real father was some hookup in a roadside bar who she never met. And I'm telling her about my evil stepmother, how my parents had to give me growth hormones so I wouldn't be 5'2". She tells me the photographer in her town, who her mom took her to at 10, was always all over her and, like, de-virginized her at 13. But she got really pissed when I asked if it had scarred her for life. Would I be talking about it if it had scarred me for life? Though she did say that when she told her mom she wanted to quit. Her mom shut her right the fuck down. They needed the money, maybe? Big, rambly, falling-apart house? She was doing print ads for local stuff. Car washes, pizza places, I don't know. One day she went to New York on a bus. I still remember weird facts about that night. When Anne and I were living in Tokyo years later, it all came back to me. Her spiel about the modeling over there. That's where she ended up. She lived in Paris for a year, but she got big in Japan. We'd get there and we'd just work. It was brutal. They'd take you from the plane, put you in a van, and drive you right to a shoot. You'd work 12 or 14-hour days. And I guess, unlike the other girls, she was drinking and going out to clubs. And one day she was hungover and she lost her shit at some big-deal Japanese photographer and she started screaming at him, telling him he was trying to mindfuck her, and that he was fucked, and Japan was fucked, and all the people were fucked. And she started throwing shit and calling the other girls cunts. Whipped the C-word right out. She went so crazy, kicking people and scratching and knocking over camera equipment and ripping her clothes, they had to drag her away and sedate her. Not a hugely great move, career-wise. She was hospitalized for 3 days, and her agent called her up in the hospital and dumped her. She called home, and her mother chose that moment to tell her her father, who she'd loved, wasn't her real father. Like she'd been holding that little bomb in reserve in case she needed to drop it, ruin a life. She didn't know what to do, and she was scared about money. When she got out of the hospital, she called a girl she knew from New York. An Australian girl. Not a model, just someone she knew from partying in New York. The girl was living in Tokyo, working as a hostess at one of the men's clubs. They wait on the men and flirt with them, and the men say titillating things to them. It's a form of relaxation in an uptight society. The girl got her a job, and to be more popular, she dyed her hair blonde because they like blondes. She slept with a few of them. It just sort of segued into that. Sounds like she was kind of checked out, kind of numb. When she got back to New York, she thought that phase of her life was over. She'd gotten her BA somehow, doing it part-time wherever she was, correspondence, I don't know. And a friend was supposed to be helping to get her a paralegal job somewhere. She was lonely, 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 though. And one night a man she knew from Japan, call him a client, I guess, came to town and called her, and since she had nothing better to do, she got all dressed up in some high-fashion outfit and lots of makeup, and went to meet him in some fancy midtown place. He stood her up, though. She was really, really miffed, because she'd been getting attitude from the bartender, and her tab by the time she realized the guy wasn't going to show was large. Hell, one drink in one of those places is $20. I really don't understand what money she was living on at this point. She said she borrowed some from her sister, but then her sister got pissed and cut her off, and she didn't have any anyway. Another guy started chatting her up, and from some odd comment he made, it sank in, even though she was pretty wasted, that he thought she was a prostitute, so she went with it. Partly just as a joke to herself, partly to see how it would pan out. Roll the dice, you know? She did nothing to correct the impression. They went back to his hotel room, some cheesy conference hotel, like, you know, the Hyatt on 6th Avenue. And in the morning when she woke up, there was $1,000 on the bedside table. In hundreds, I remember she told me. It was in hundreds. She thought about returning the money or just leaving it there in the hotel room. But it didn't really resonate as some watershed moment for her, so she kept it. That was maybe a year, year and a half before I met her. I didn't ask her how many times she'd been back to the place. She said she went there sometimes and that she got hooked up with Petra Anikov. Google it if you don't know. But that this paralegal job was really supposed to materialize. I still remember what she said. She said, "I think I would enjoy working in a corporate atmosphere." Isn't that funny? Sweet, really. I just kept going back to the fact that she had gone to Dunning, even though she didn't graduate, and she got on that bus to New York. I was floored. I mean, we played them. "But you must meet people you know from there," I said. She said no, the worlds were pretty different. That was back in the days of, you know, Eurotrash, and the city was different then. There was no email, people could get lost, and they did get lost. She said, knock wood, she'd never run into someone she knew. "This is a generation whose only reference is to college," she said. I got the feeling she was quoting someone, that someone had laid this line on her. And I didn't go to college. I don't know what it was, but talking about Dunning and boarding school, she was asking me what sports I played. It was such a turn-on. The speed must have kicked in. I was wide, wide awake. So we did it again, and it was so fucking late, maybe 4 in the morning. And fuck it if I didn't still have the goddamn Series 7 test in the morning. I started to sober up the minute the night faded. In a way, I felt a little cheated. You know, I wanted my "I hired a prostitute" story, and instead I felt like I'd paid a friend of a friend to have sex with me. I got kind of dickish. I was like, "So what do you charge for this? What do you charge for that?" I'm like, "What would you do if someone wanted to have a threesome with you and another girl? What would you do if someone wanted to have anal sex with you?" She gave me this blank look and said, "Charge more, guy. Charge double." At dawn, I went out to get money from the ATM. I came back to the apartment and I paid her what I owed her, but I only had 20s from the cash machine. and I also owed her for the sandwiches because she had paid and I couldn't come up with exact change. By this point, I was trying to get her out of there, so I'm going, keep it, keep it, keep it. Nope, I won't. Well, then I'll keep it. Back and forth like that. Finally, she takes a $20 bill and rips it in half. Starts laughing this crazy laugh. I'm like, what the fuck? That's American currency you're destroying. I could report you. That was the last thing I said to her. What a weenie-ish thing to say, huh? I hated myself for it. Chris called then, from a payphone in Sheepshead Bay. Dude, you gotta send a car service out here to get me. And when I hung up, she was gone. I sat there shaking. I felt so bad, and trying to study, and I showered and shaved, and I went in, and somehow, mercy of God, I passed. Chris and I went out for drinks the next weekend, and after a couple beers, I told him I slept with her. I wanted to correct the impression he had that I hadn't gotten laid. I shouldn't have. You couldn't trust Chris. I felt really bad. But what did I do? I was tired of his always having the upper hand, you know, ragging on me about Vivi. I was going to leave the stuff out about Dunning, keep that to myself. But Chris is a fucking bloodhound. He could get anything out of me, even if I knew he was going to turn it against me. And Chris had a chip on his shoulder about boarding school, so I knew it would come back to bite me in the ass. He's like, man, oh man. The rumor got around the office. I was scared shitless. They'd fired a guy for going to a strip club, for God's sake. Okay, he'd tried to expense it. I wasn't that stupid. But I lived in utter fear for weeks on end. I felt nauseated all the time. I ended up with an ulcer. 23, and I had an ulcer. When the gossip faded, Chris asked me about her, and I said I hadn't seen her again. And he said he'd dug her up, and he'd seen her. And he'd passed her on to this complete fucking shithead, John Curtis. It was like the worst day of my life. Chris was annoying, but man, I hated John Curtis. A real, vile, despicable person. He'd walk around with this expression on his face, smuggest motherfucker. I just wanted to kill him. I don't even know how we knew him. He wasn't in the training program with us. You know what I did? It was so pathetic. I went to 5757 to try to warn her about the guy. Of course, she was nowhere near there. No one was. No Russian girls, nothing. I got a $20 gin and tonic and didn't even drink it. I wasn't going to ask Chris if Curtis ever called her, so, I mean, I never found out what happened to her. Except then I did. 18 months ago, she showed up at the new parents' night at school. She wasn't new. She already had one through. But her second kid was starting. I was new, though. Anne and I were new. So excited to be there among the chosen. It took a minute. A few minutes. Because, of course, she's actually a brunette. Mrs. Davidson was talking, and I was staring across the room at her. And when I got it, when I figured out how I knew her, I almost shat myself. I acted like a total dick, I'm sorry to say. I didn't say hi to her. Well, I pretended not to know who she was. I cut her. I was so jittery I couldn't talk to anyone, couldn't concentrate on anything. I kept refilling my wine, couldn't talk to Anne at all. Was kind of a jerk to her, too. We had it out in the cab going home. Not that I mentioned her. I was just wigging out, to be honest, totally wigging out. I'd wondered what had happened to her once or twice. Okay, 1,000 times. But I mean, it never occurred to me that she would go mainstream. If you'd asked me, I'd have said she'd leave New York and live in some second-tier suburb. You know, condo near the train kind of thing. Piece something together. Get old quick. Or some alterna life in Europe. Married to somebody you couldn't see past the American. I would have figured that that'd be all she could have gotten. Shows you how shallow I am. After I'd brushed by her a couple of times and pretended not to see her looking at me, I noticed Jed Skinker. He'd come in late. Think I overheard somebody say, the Skinkers. And I still didn't get that they were a couple. Not till the end of the night when they took us on a tour through the halls to see the kids' artwork did I grasp it. I mean, not merely mainstream, but Skinker. Jedediah Hussey Skinker. I interviewed with them. It was new parents' night. I guess I said that. Anyway, at some point I'm alone, just kind of staring into space. Supposed to be looking at collages on the walls. And she comes over and just says, "Hi, guy." She looks, I don't know, so beautiful. Like an utter tool, I go really loudly. It's very nice to see you again. Like all formal, all stiff, like I don't know her. I'm all, please, take your seats. The concert is about to begin. You know? God, how lame. How frickin' lame. Hi, hi, it's nice to see you again. She says quietly, it's nice to see you too. I got up in the middle of the night that night and snuck into the bathroom. I've got gold taps and leaping zebra wallpaper in there, and framed photos of Anne's coming out ball in Newport, and I cried like a motherfucker. I just bawled. I think in some way, I always thought she was holding out for me. I'm still in investment banking. I've been a managing director for 2 years,